Welcome to Open for Discussion, a University of Sydney podcast looking at research through a personal and critical lens. I'm your host, Chris Neff. Today I'm chatting with Professor Nicole Garin from the Faculty of Architecture, Design, and Planning about her extensive research on how we could help more people afford to live where they want. Nicole is an urban planner and policy analyst from the Faculty of Architecture, Design, and Planning, and she joins me in my office today to cut through the confusion. Nicole, welcome to Open for Discussion.
Nice to be here.
So take us back to the start. Where did your personal interest in housing policy come from?
Well, my personal interest, if you want to go all the way back, was probably when I was a kid, and we lived in a variety of different places until I went to school, and we spent several years in a caravan park. But then once we moved into our house, sort of the favourite activity for my mother and I was driving around looking at all of the other houses on the hill, safe, away from the floodwaters and permanent and dry.
My grandmother used to own a caravan park.
Wow.
Yeah. Little did we know we had so much in common. Yeah. And then the question is, you know, if 70% of Australians own a home, what's the housing crisis that we keep hearing about?
That's a historical figure. The rate of home ownership now in Australia is slipping down. So we're now around 67%. But the point that you hit on is very real. Because most Australian households still do live in their own home, they've been cushioned, in a sense, from the changing housing system that's affecting younger generations, people on low and moderate incomes, people who are still in the rental market, and people who might actually, you know, following, say, a divorce, for instance, or falling into unemployment for a period of time, people who might actually fall out of home ownership and then find it very difficult to get back on.
My theory, so I've lived in Sydney for 8 years, and my theory has been I'll never own a home because the cost just seems to be extraordinary, just always seems to be too high. Mm-hmm. I currently live in a granny flat in Newtown. I'm paying $510 a week. My income, none of the listeners can tell anyone, but it is in the enterprise bargaining agreement, so it's not like it's a secret, is $91,000. What do you think? Am I paying too much? It's a studio one bedroom.
You should be paying no more than 30% of your income on housing, and that's your gross income. So you're probably nudging around about the affordable end of things.
Yeah, but if I had a husband.
Then you might be able to think about home purchase, particularly if he was on a similar income to you. You probably would then find yourself in the higher income bracket. And now if you want to purchase in Sydney, you really do need to be on a high income.
So the housing crisis is a 69% crisis. So is it a crisis?
I mean, that's a really good question. Housing affordability pressures affect people on low and moderate incomes who aren't in home ownership or who are struggling with very high mortgages. But it's a particular crisis that's affecting people on low, very low, and possibly moderate incomes, particularly larger households. Now, at the top end, so where you are, the crisis is in being able to find appropriate rental housing or moving into home ownership and being able to save up enough of a deposit. Now, in the 70s, you could save up a deposit on, you know, less than probably half of your yearly income. So you might have needed the equivalent in today's dollars of about $45,000 to have a deposit. Now you need a lot more than that to even be able to get a loan. Where it really bites, of course, is people on very low incomes, so around about $30,000 a year, people on low incomes around about $50,000 a year. And we know in Sydney, around about half of them are paying more than 30% of their income on rent. And 30% of a very low income leaves you very little else.
That's
medicine, food.
Those are my students. That's who I worry about when I think about these numbers. And I think about, you know, they've just moved here from Wollongong or they moved here from Brisbane and they're living in a share house with seven people to try to keep the rent down. But even then they're paying $300 a week. So they're clearly not going to be able to afford to buy. Is the rental market going to get better then?
Actually, rents have risen higher than incomes, so have house prices over the past decade. And the issue is, of course, with people like your demographic, who once would have been moving into home ownership as soon as they found a degree of stability, often when they got married, with people unable to do that, that puts pressure on the rental market, and there you are competing. And so we've seen a shortage of affordable rental supply. Now, the only way that we're able to improve that situation is if we've got a dedicated amount of housing that's really, we're looking at rents that are subsidised or rents that are kept to an amount of money that people can actually afford to pay.
How does that compare with other locations? Is, you know, Hong Kong or London or San Francisco or these other expensive cities?
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about more affordable rental housing, that could be public housing provided by the government. It could be what's called social housing, which could be provided by a non-profit community housing organisation. But in comparison to the rest of the world, absolutely, Australia rates very low on that totem pole of having a sort of safety net or even a viable alternative for people in terms of affordable rental housing. So in Hong Kong, about 45% of people in Hong Kong are living in subsidised rental or low-cost home ownership that's being provided through a public housing scheme.
So Australia's at 4% and Hong Kong's at 45%?
Yeah. And what you're putting your finger on is one of the solutions. This is one of the solutions to the burgeoning affordable housing crisis in Australia, and that is to build up the non-profit sector. And that means non-profit providers who are able to develop and offer affordable rental housing, possibly affordable home ownership. But still, to be able to build up that sector will require access to land in the right locations. And it'll also require access to government funding and government incentives to make the development of that housing viable. In South Australia, a scheme like that works very well. So when land is rezoned for housing development or for higher density housing development in South Australia, 15% of the homes produced in that scheme must be offered as either low-cost home ownership or affordable rental.
So I was having brunch with a friend and he said, Australia is an island. There's only limited land. There's only limited places to build houses. Housing prices can't ever go down as the population goes up. It's just always, it's a great investment because it's always going to go up. Is he right or is he wrong?
Look, the supply as the reason for house prices escalating dramatically is part of the answer, in as much as everyone needs to live in essentially six mm-hmm. places in Australia, the capital cities and maybe not the two smallest capital cities. So there are inherent supply constraints there that provide a natural floor to the housing market. But what we've seen is actually when prices do rise, we've seen a sudden increase in development activity once again in Australia. So that's where I'd say the supply myth has been overplayed. Okay. And in fact, you hear on the news now people warning about an oversupply in some markets. But we've had a very distracting conversation for the last decade about the planning system being the regulatory constraint, being the explanation for lower levels of housing production than were expected and for prices remaining high. When actually, I think the evidence now, and certainly my research, and I've spent the last decade trying to understand where those planning constraints might be, and not been able to determine any relationship between that regulatory framework and patterns of housing development in Australia. I mean, one of the things that I think is important to understand about the housing market is generally what brings prices down is not necessarily from within the market itself. It's generally an external shock. So even with the global financial crisis, it was driven by the mortgage market, but in a sense that was a finance crisis rather than a housing crisis per se. We were cushioned from that in Australia, in part because the way that we provide housing is not as fluid. To build a house in Australia, generally, houses are actually contracted by the people who either want to live in them or who want to buy them at the end. So we have actually very little speculative housing development. So that, I think, has been one factor that has kept supply very closely connected to demand. That may change in the future as we get more investors in the housing market than we've had in the past.
Do you think it would be good or bad for Australia to have a more speculative market?
We're experimenting with that at the moment, and we're not seeing any benefits for affordable housing, because all we're seeing is housing being treated like an investment but not as a dwelling, and all we're getting as a result of that is new dwellings that aren't necessarily affordable for people on low and moderate incomes. And there I'm referring to the phenomenal increase, sudden increase in apartment building that we've seen in the central cities.
Are there other solutions for people in other tax brackets? We can try and increase public housing for people at the lower end. Is there anything for people who are in the upper end, sort of the middle class person who is priced out of the market?
We haven't been good at serving that end of the market, and I think that's where we do need a lot of policy development. It's not terribly hard, in my view. The South Australian model, I think, is a good model, and it can work in a lot of markets. It's more difficult in the very high value markets, unless you have new investment that suddenly increases the price of land, such as a train or a light rail would be a perfect place to start trialling some low cost home ownership in the cities. But I think we also have to look more at balanced development in Australia. At the moment, we're focusing very much on the major population centres, and we know that jobs and economic growth has been very much concentrated around the inner ring of cities like Sydney and Melbourne, and to a lesser extent, the other capital cities. And I think we do have to look more carefully at how we can spread economic opportunity back out to the regions. And with that, that also brings the opportunity for more affordable housing just delivered through the market, because we've got more choice in terms of where we can live.
You're listening to Open for Discussion, a University of Sydney podcast that looks at research through a personal and critical lens. I'm your host, Chris Neff, and today I'm talking about the great Australian dream of home ownership with Professor Nicole Guerin, a planner and policy analyst who researches Australian housing. So, Nicole, how do you find your research is received? Do you feel like your research gets taken and then implemented, or do you find it being misapplied, or what has been your experience? So you've got 10 years and you're telling people they're having the wrong conversation. How do they react to that?
Well, there's been two aspects to my work. In fact, quite a lot of my research has actually been looking at opportunities to borrow from the United States and the United Kingdom, where as a sort of remedy to exclusionary zoning, inclusionary zoning techniques basically require that when new development happens, that a proportion of that be dedicated to people on low and moderate income. So these inclusionary zoning approaches in the United States and in the United Kingdom, very long traditions of using the planning system to develop a very solid pipeline of affordable homes in those two countries, has never really taken off. And so quite a lot of my research has actually been looking at opportunities to borrow those practices and apply them in the Australian case. But as soon as you start talking about inclusionary zone in Australia, then you get resistance from, for instance, the Property Council of Australia. You get resistance from industry groups who say the planning system overall is the problem, the planning system overall is constraining housing development. And if you want to include new requirements that might, for instance, require some sharing of profits for affordable housing, that will only make things worse.
So is it about really having a concern about housing and planning, or is it a concern about having poor people living in your neighbourhood?
You've hit on exactly the reason why we haven't been able to move forward with inclusionary housing in Australia to date, though I hope that's changing. One is the developer opposition, because if developers don't want to do anything that they don't have to do, why would they? You know, we're talking about the private sector, and it will always be in the interest of the private sector to have regulations that allow the maximum profit, and that's fine. We need to accept that. At the same time, we need to make sure that our public regulations do maximise welfare for the broader community. And so using the planning system to say, hang on, through no effort of your own, just because you've got a site here and we've decided that that site can accept higher density housing, all of a sudden your land is worth, you know, 300 or 400% more than it was worth yesterday. All we want to do with an inclusionary housing approach is say, let's share some of that to provide some affordable housing. Now, on the other side of things, you do have hostility within local communities to the idea of any type of change at all, so medium and high density housing, but also housing that's specifically for people on low and moderate income groups. And often that's a lack of understanding about who those people might be. And I think that's where local government and state government can play an important educational role.
We're in Australia. This is one of the largest land masses. So there is a lot of land. Is there anything we can do? I mean, I take the train from Sydney to Blue Mountains, and there's lots of greenery, there's lots of forests, there's lots of land. Is there a way to use that to try to alleviate some of the housing issues?
I mean, that's an interesting question. That has been the model for Australian urban and suburban development, you know, almost till now. What we've found, of course, is that jobs have become increasingly concentrated in the inner cities, and therefore the distance that people are having to travel is getting ever greater. So that's one issue. We're also finding that people's actual housing preferences are shifting towards being wanting to live in centres where they can walk to at least the shops. Hopefully the kids can walk to school. So that's an important part of the picture. But it's important to say that we are actually developing a lot of land on the suburban fringe as well. It's not as though it's only about inner urban development, but we have to ask how long that can continue. I mean, Sydney's population is about half the population of London's, and yet we take up about 8 times the land mass. So, you know, it gives us an idea that at some point we can't continue the old model of suburban development. But I think we also have to start thinking about how we can create opportunities in the regional cities that exist as well.
Is there an alternative to that as well, which is just to build taller in the cities that you've got? I mean, because you knock down 2-story, 3-story homes and build 12-story homes? Mm. Or is there a really good reason to not do that?
I think there's a misconception that's portrayed sometimes by the development industry that if you allow high density housing everywhere, then it will magically fill up. And certainly I think sometimes you hear economists talking like that, as though there's some artificial constraint on supply, when actually you have to look at the land economics and what people actually are prepared to pay for, what type of product they're interested in. People don't necessarily want to live in a 2-bedroom apartment in a tower in, you know, the western suburbs, a long way away from public transport. But what we're not seeing is the market being able to produce homes that are affordable to you, and you're, you know, on a reasonably good salary, and certainly not affordable to people on lower incomes. And we're not able to build our way out of that problem. We do need some type of policy intervention to make sure that when we do build, whether they're towers or whether they're homes on the fringe, we need a level of policy intervention to make sure a portion of those are affordable, and hopefully as well that a portion of them can be rented as affordable rental products as well.
And what have politicians said to you when you've said this to them? I mean, this is Australia. This is a major issue across the entire country. What do people say when you explain that, you know, there are sort of best practices, there are some countries that do it better than Australia, here's a model that we can adopt?
There's a lot of hand-wringing. There's been a number of government working parties set up and pilot programs and parliamentary inquiries. And you're right, you know, we don't seem to see much action. And I think the recent debate around negative gearing is a great example of sort of where the politics of Australian housing policy lie. And with, you know, nearly 70% of people who are homeowners who've seen their personal wealth on paper at least seem to grow, and not just on paper, homeowners are now, as a result of the last two property booms, much, much wealthier than people who aren't in home ownership. So there's very high stakes in maintaining the current status quo.
And is part of that then to artificially support the bubble so that people remain happy with politicians in major cities, or anything that's going to cause that bubble to burst is a political liability. Is that fair?
It's not as simple as that. Governments are anxious about property markets going down, and with good reason. The whole, you know, consumer spending is to a degree propped up now by people's sense of housing wealth. But there is a way that we can both maintain a sort of stable housing market and achieve sort of the sweet spot of stable housing production, which is good for the industry, without bringing prices down, which isn't particularly good for anybody actually, because if prices go down, you start to get less house building as well. But the way to do both, in a sense, is to build up that non-profit housing sector. It's to build up the sector able to provide low-cost home ownership and affordable rental, and to sort of build the number of players who aren't dependent on prices continuing to rise.
I like that a lot. I'm so pleased that you could join us here on Open for Discussion.
You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud. Let us know your thoughts on housing affordability where you live. You can find me on Twitter @ChristopherNeff.